supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to a Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. These days, we're hearing more and more about happiness. You know, like three easy steps to happiness forever. But what is it? And how can we find more happiness in our daily lives? Moreover, if you're unhappy or even suffer from depression, is there a way you can teach yourself or be taught how to feel happier? And is there such a thing as too much happiness? Well, that's what we're going to take a look at today, the science of happiness. Joining me is Dr. Keltner. He's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and founding director of the Greater Good Science Center. We also have Dr. June Gruber from the University of Colorado in Boulder. June is the director of the Positive Emotion and Psychopathology Lab. Later on, we'll hear from Rachel Drain. She'll join us to talk about her battle with depression and journey to happiness. So, June, let me start with you. What is this thing anyway, this happiness? Is it something we experience, like, you know, a wedding, seeing a lover's smile, a hot fudge sundae, or is it a state of being?
Well, I think you're asking a really important question, and I think it's one we're all eagerly trying to figure out. What exactly is happiness? And I think one thing I can say in response to your question is it's not one thing. So psychologists who've been trying to tackle what happiness is have come to think that maybe it's something that has multiple pieces or ingredients. And there's some agreement that, you know, there might be three kind of central ingredients of happiness. One is experiencing frequent and, moderately or intense positive emotions. The second piece that people often talk about is experiencing infrequent and low levels of negative emotions. And the third component is thought to be really kind of a cognitive evaluation or reflection of your life as a whole, kind of this question of, are you satisfied with your life? So those are the three ingredients that people have traditionally talked about when it comes to happiness. But now there's even a question of whether or not that's really capturing everything and whether we still are very much in search of what is the true meaning of happiness and sort of how do we find it.
I'm wondering about the experience of happiness. How do you describe the experience of happiness? Are there words for it?
Well, I think that, as June said, there are multiple facets to our state of happiness. And so one is the realm of positive emotion. And I think that there is really good evidence now coming out in the last couple of years for really 10 to different 12 different kinds of positive states that make up our happiness. Things like gratitude and awe and compassion and love and joy and ecstasy and mirth. And then a second thing that June talked about is kind of this deeper structure to happiness that is part of our experience that you might call meaning, where people, you know, have this sense that in the state of happiness, they are really feeling like they are doing what they're supposed to be doing here on earth. And that would manifest in feeling a sense of purpose or a sense of mission or calling. So that also suffuses the experience of happiness. And then, you know, there's this third piece of just how's my life going, you know, and this cognitive evaluation that June talked about. And that is also part of how happiness works and how it is experienced.
Well, we hear from individuals to politicians. Who has time to think about the big picture? You know, and I know very few people that do, which is kind of sad when you think about it. Do you consider yourself a happy person, Doctor?
Well, you know, I am, you know, if the worldwide average is, the average in the United States is a 7 on a 10-point scale. I probably came into the world, given particular genetic propensities, as a 6. And I think that this being immersed in this happiness science has brought me up to a 7 or a 7.5. But, I still battle demons but find a lot of purpose and resolve in this happiness science.
June, how about you?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because the more you study happiness, the more complicated it is to answer that question, I find. There's this one study that came out that really had me rethinking how happy am I. And this is a study that was done by a colleague of Dacher and myself, Maya Tamir, that looked at the extent to which people's emotions that they feel really links to how happy they are in kind of a broader sense. And she found something really interesting that I've been thinking about in my everyday life, which was it's not about feeling good or feeling bad, but how closely aligned are the emotions you want to be feeling with the emotions you're actually feeling. And the closer those are linked, the more kind of happy at a broader sense people report feeling. So if you're someone who really wants to be feeling some degree of sadness or wants to be feeling some degree of pride, the closer you are to that goal, the happier you are. So when I think about whether I'm happy, I'm often thinking about, are the emotions that I feel linked to the ones I want to be feeling? So to answer your question, I think generally yes, but those values change all the time. And so I think it's kind of a moving target in a way, whether or not you're happy on a given day. But I think Dacher's right that just studying the science of happiness isn't going to magically make you happy. That's really not what it's about. It's more about understanding how we are as humans and how we all work, and what are the things that, make us happy and make us unhappy, and how much of that in many ways is within our control or should be something we strive towards.
June, I want to ask you about the book you published a couple of years ago. It was Positive Emotion, Integrating the Light Sides and the Dark Sides. Tell us about the dark side.
Yeah, so I often, answer that question with the caveat that there's not this sort of hidden dark mystery of positive emotions, but really I think any emotion, including positive, have many different facets to them, right? So a lot of what we've understood about positive emotions has been, quote, the light side, or the ways in which it, promotes adaptive physical health outcomes, alleviates symptoms of anxiety and depression. But there is another piece to it, and I think understanding that piece, or what you referred to as the dark side, really helps us appreciate it more generally. So what we looked at in that book are some of the conditions or ways in which positive emotions do not always predict what we think of as beneficial outcomes. And we looked at this both in individuals with a history of psychiatric disorders, so depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders, and those without, and really kind of summarize what we think of as kind of the top 5 themes or ways positive emotions may sometimes go awry. So that can be the size or magnitude when we experience them too intensely. The second is the situation or experiencing them in contexts where they may not actually be appropriate. The third is specificity. So this is kind of a lot of the work that I learned while working as a student in Dacher's lab, that we know there's a wide variety of positive emotions, as Dacher said at the outset of this interview, and that some of them, especially those that may be very self-focused, like pride, we've actually seen linked to the onset of aggressive behaviors, increased risk for the onset of mania, and antisocial behaviors. So it depends on what kinds of positive emotions you're talking about. That's really important. And the last two really look at things related to the diversity of emotions we experience, that it's actually not about optimizing and maximizing positive emotions all the time, but about experiencing a diversity or range of positive and negative emotions. That seems really critical to sort of optimal functioning and navigating the world in everyday life. And the last is one that Iris Mouse and colleagues have looked at in terms of striving or wanting to feel positive emotions. And actually, the more people want to experience positive emotions and put, you know, specific effort on that as the end goal, it seems to even paradoxically backfire and kind of predict both concurrent, so right now, and also future or prospective symptoms of depression, bipolar disorder, and other maladies. So we really tried to kind of explore these themes more in depth in that book to just better understand what are the conditions in which, you know, positive emotions might really contribute to well-being, and what are some of the caveats or boundary conditions surrounding them.
So thank you, June. Dr. In my parents' generation in the 40s, through 60s, their lives were about getting a roof over our head and a safe neighborhood and saving enough money to help us go to college. They certainly weren't pursuing happiness. Why this sudden interest?
Well, I think the sudden interest is both scientific and cultural, and the scientific interest is that there was just a lot of uncharted territory in the human psyche, right? We just didn't know what compassion is, or gratitude, or the sense of wonder, or beauty, or there are just really dozens of unanswered questions. And then I think that the science of happiness really exploded on the scene in the late 1980s and in the early 2000s, in a particularly troubled political time, post 9/11 attacks. There was this sense that, you know, with the economic conditions of our society and inequality and changing job markets, that people were, there was a malaise that was broad, and people were really interested in what is the meaningful life and where do I find joy? And then I think that there was also this broad trend that first was noted by people like Robert Putnam, that the basic communal structure of American society, of being together like your parents and working and serving your kids and, you know, going to the picnic and the softball league, had kind of broken down, and people were spending a lot of time, as they do today, by themselves. And these cultural conditions just started to make this question really poignant, right? Which is, why am I not with the people I love as much as I'd like to be, and what makes me happy?
You know, consistent with that, an 8th century Buddhist monk said, whatever joy there is in the world all comes from my desiring others to be happy. But whatever suffering there is in the world all comes from my desiring myself to be happy. So, June, I want to turn to you. Can't this pursuit of happiness lead us down a path of self-absorption?
I mean, I think you're definitely hitting on something that has become a really important concern in, you know, the science of happiness, which is, what is the right way to go about finding happiness, right? It's something we're all, you know, interested in, something we all want to understand better, and something we all, in one way or another, strive to attain. So what is the right way to go about it? And I think this is where some of this work on the striving of happiness has really brought home a really humbling message, which is that at least one of the paths we ought not to go down is to really set our sight on the end goal of doing something simply insofar as it makes us happy, right? So that we pick up the latest kind of, you know, self-help book, hoping that it will tell us what we need to do simply to become happy. And at least we know that if that's our end goal, and if we're engaging in activities simply because they are going to make us feel happy, or we believe that to be the case, that's actually going to lead us to wanting happiness more, to, you know, as I mentioned, work by Iris Mouse and colleagues, setting up expectations for how happy we ought to be. All these sorts of things are going to set us up to actually probably feel less happy in the moment. And so it's turned attention towards maybe, you know, moving our spotlight away from happiness as the end outcome to, as Dacher mentioned at the beginning, focused on things that bring meaning and social connection to others. And as a consequence, those are likely to make us feel happy, likely to make us feel, you know, good and connected. But we really just need to be shifting our spotlight on what is the ultimate end goal we're moving towards.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in 1 minute. You are listening to Dr. June Gruber. She's a professor of psychology at University of Colorado Boulder, which was named one of the happiest cities in the country, by the way. She's also the director of the Positive Emotion and Psychopathology Lab, alongside with Dr. Keltner, a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to this Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Today we're talking about the science of happiness. Joining me again is Dr. Keltner, a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. Several years ago, you wrote the Ten Commandments for Happiness. The first commandment that you have is to laugh. Really? The first commandment?
Yeah, you know, so this is in the spirit of what we teach at UC Berkeley in the science of happiness, which is there are four or five positive states or social behaviors that you can seek out and practice. And I wrote laugh as number one because I think our culture is too stressed. And there are a lot of data showing rises in stress in every demographic sector the past 30 years, in particular teenagers these days. And laughter is this wonderful process by which we both not take ourselves so seriously or our lives so seriously, and then we connect to others in this exhilarating and delightful way. And it's often undervalued in our serious efforts at finding happiness, right? We think about service and compassion and success, and we forget that here is this incredibly interesting, deeply evolved process, laughter, that is right there for us to keep us happy.
I don't know if you remember, many years ago, Mel Brooks produced and starred in a movie called History of the World Part 1. So in this segment of the movie, Moses, Mel Brooks, is walking down the mount, and he's saying, God has given us, he's got three tablets, God has given us 15 commandments, and then he steps on a rock and one tablet drops, and he says, no, 10 commandments. God has given us 10 commandments. So in my little mind, for years I wondered what might have been on the other tablet. And I convinced myself that the 11th commandment was, thou shalt not take thyself too seriously. And for my money, I definitely think it should have been in the top 10.
I agree. And I think, you know, one of the perils of pursuing happiness too vigorously is we take ourselves too seriously, right? We're always trying to have the perfect moment, what Barry Schwartz called sort of a maximizing of happiness and pleasure. And I think that laughter and play and satire and goofing around and rough and tumble wrestling and nicknames and even teasing, where we do it in a lighthearted, loving way, they are lighthearted ways that we say, no matter what I'm facing, there's always a lighthearted perspective on this. In our lab, we're often interested in what are the kind of the signature ways in which you can find a happy person. And one, I think, that is underappreciated is the ability to laugh at the self and not take things too seriously.
You addressed this striving for happiness and working hard to get happiness.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of like frantically rushing around so you can make time to relax?
It is, you know, and that is a challenge, which is, you know, we know from a lot of the science that, 5-10 minutes of gratitude practice a week will boost your happiness. 5-10 minutes of volunteerism will boost your happiness, or basic mindful breathing exercises will boost happiness. And then the challenge is to fit it into our busy days, which are busier than ever. This is hard work, right? This is a life's work, is to find meaning and joy and connectedness. And here are 15 things you can do. And then we take more of almost an Eastern approach to this. And I'm glad you cited the 8th century monk, which is, you know, this, we can't prescribe this. We can't tell you exactly what to do. That's your process of discovery, and it's hard, and you'll misstep, and and fumble. But what we do know, if you can integrate a few different practices, like a gratitude practice or a stress reduction mindfulness practice, it's going to help your health and happiness. And then the challenge is to find out how to do that in the context of your life.
Years ago, I treated a woman who was working full-time and had a severe debilitating depression. Medication didn't touch her. And this is before the supplementary interventions were developed, like, electromagnetic stimulation, those things. So she needed to take a leave of absence, and she really did, or else she would have lost her job. But just giving someone more time, a depressed person more time, is not good. So I said, I'll sign the letter for your leave of absence, but you have to make a commitment to volunteer 3 days a week anywhere where you're helping living beings. So she did, and after a couple of months of that, and we increased the time, she was feeling much better. She went back to her psychiatrist, she got on medication, and it worked this time. So there's something about that, about volunteering and getting outside of your own head, that has to make you happier than you are.
Yeah, this kind of observation and then the science it connects to, Dan, was to me one of the most important discoveries in the science, right? That when we volunteer later in life, we live longer. When we, Elizabeth Dunn's work, when we give away money, we're happier than when we spend it on the self. Stephanie Brown and others showing when we give to others, it activates reward circuits in the brain, and when we sacrifice for others, the same. And it tells us we really very deeply and reliably find happiness when we lift up the welfare of other people. And maybe there is a mythical dimension to trying to find happiness inside of your head.
These days, Doctor, when I ask my audience, what would you rather have, well-being or happiness? The overwhelming majority chooses well-being. Is that what we want?
It is, and I think that this has been a really important addition or evolution in the science of happiness. You know, we early on thought it was just this, like you framed this conversation, this transient state, like, oh, I'm really enjoying this meal, or I'm enjoying, being outside. And I think that there's been this increasing attention to the deeper well-being and meaning of, I volunteer in a prison, and every time I go there, as do many prison volunteers, you feel profoundly sad afterwards and inspired and also angry at our criminal justice system, right? And the biases that are in it, and what it's doing. And those are tough emotions, right? They don't necessarily translate to like, oh, I just feel good right now. But they are deeply meaningful, and they are deeply engaging. So I do think that the science of happiness has become more open to these other kinds of experiences that may not feel good in the moment, but really take you to important places in life in your interactions with others.
What about if somebody doesn't have meaning in their life? Where do you go looking for that?
People have been wondering about the absence of meaning for a long time, and sociologists wrote about anomie, and when you don't feel like you have purpose in society, and eudaimonia, the Greek concept, is related to it as well. And I really like how you're framing the question, Dan, which is, if I don't feel meaning right now, if I'm a teenager who's engaged in self-harm, or like the person you referred to of having this really incapacitating depression, in a way those are the conditions in which meaning is absent. And I feel like I always tell people what you just said, which is, all right, find something where you're volunteering and go do that. And then secondly is what Susan Nolan Huxema, one of the leading scholars on depression, said, is just get out and be with people, right? Go for a walk in the woods, go have a beer with friends. And the third one I'm really interested in is to get out in nature. And it's striking to me how just getting out in the woods for a day, going for a walk in an arboretum, gives you some meaning. So I think they're really practical things we can advise people.
I want to go further with this getting out in nature. What is it about getting out in nature that gives us meaning?
Well, right now, I think we're starting to zero in on a couple of things. And one is this emotion of awe, which, you know, a lot of nature, you know, if you're at Yosemite or you're around the great coastal redwoods that are 350 feet tall, or you're watching the flowers bloom in spring in Wisconsin, or you're, you know, in the eastern mountains, there's just awesomeness to it, right, in terms of size and time. And we are now learning in a lot of replicated data that when I feel awe, I have perspective on life. You know, I suddenly realize, like, wow, my worries in my career are really kind of trivial when I think about the broad pattern of nature and how long this tree has been around. So awe is one candidate. And then the second is our minds find beauty, and it calms the nervous system in looking at all the beauty of patterns in nature, the symmetry and harmony and complex patterns that you see in flowers and rivers and trees and, you know, spring and fall and the change of seasons. It all evokes this sense of beauty, which is different from awe, and also has these really, really impressive benefits for people.
So I just traveled to Switzerland and saw the Matterhorn, and I cried. So, I mean, I was experiencing awe and happiness and gratitude and all of those positive emotions, and I'm crying. It doesn't make sense on the surface.
Well, you know, this is why, you know, my lab has devoted a lot of attention to this. So when we use a word to describe a behavior, we necessarily mask the varieties of behaviors that are captured with that word. So my lab's worked a lot on smiles and laughter. And when we say, well, that person's smiling, right? They could be in love or they could be sarcastic and contemptuous. So the word doesn't capture all the richness of smiling. Same with laughter. You can have a laughter that is the laughter of an old married couple that are joyfully reflecting on their lives, or a laughter of a bully who's picking on a smaller kid. So, and then I think the same is true of crying. There's tears of sadness and joy and beauty and awe. And I think that they have to do in some sense with when integration or communion, when things come together, we often cry. But science has yet to figure that one out.
Most people, they work all year. They pack their suitcases and go somewhere, Switzerland or the Grand Canyon or wherever, and experience awe. But, you know, doing that once a year is not going to change the way your brain functions. And can we teach ourselves to experience awe in the leaves right outside our window?
One of the surprising findings that provides an answer to your question is, you know, we in China and the United States and Japan and many different countries, Spain, had people keep diaries every day for 2 weeks and just respond in an open-ended way. Did they feel awe or not? And we found in these different countries that people feel awe about twice a week. And as we dug into the details, we found that people will feel awe in the big experience, right? They're you know, in the Amazon or they're in the Andes or whatever. But they also feel a lot of awe in the daily sort of traffic of their lives. So they'll feel awe when they watch little preschoolers play, right? Or they'll feel awe with the changing of the leaves in fall. Or they feel awe when they volunteer and they think how strong this person is that they're assisting. So there are all these everyday sources of awe. And I think one of the directions the science of happiness is moving is to start to cultivate that, right? Just to, once you know what the concept is, then, like, we're doing some research now with people who are vulnerable to dementia, and just having them go out and do an awe walk once a week where you pick your favorite place. I have several on the Berkeley campus, and I just walk and look at the trees and listen and hear the sounds and think about changing light. And I think that awe is much more available to us than we might imagine.
You know, we can train ourselves. You know, you said people experience awe twice a week, but, you know, if they focus on the experience of awe, that number is likely to climb.
Yeah, I agree. And then once you know, it's so interesting, and this is where science is useful, which is, so one of the findings, and we surveyed 26 different countries about what makes them feel awe, and a lot of people feel awe when they watch little kids, like how they learn about the environment and fall and walk and explore. And, you know, when grandparents have their grandkids and they're just exhilarated by the experience, which I find to be a pretty reliable boost in happiness is having grandkids, not that I've had them myself. I think awe is part of that story. It's like you're watching young kids. You know, when we watch nature shows, I think a primary motivator of that experience is the awesome qualities that Darwin appreciated of the natural world. You know, and the same with music. So I do feel, like you said, once we grasp something like awe and think of its meanings and sources, then it suddenly, we focus on it, we see it and feel it a lot more frequently.
You mentioned grandchildren. It's awe and delight. And one of the things I've tried to do with Sam is corrupt him just to get back at my daughter, you know? So, and there's a great deal of pleasure in that. One last thing about awe before we move
sure.
on. In my latest book, I observed that baby and toddlers can find awe in a house key. But what happened to that?
Yeah.
You know, it just seems to go away. So my first question is, what's the matter with us? I know we don't have time to answer that. Is there a way we can reclaim what's already in there?
So what's the matter with us? You know, children, awe is about, you know, right after awe comes wonder. And wonder is this state that where you don't know things and you need to figure them out. Like what produces the perception of a rainbow, which fascinated Newton and Descartes. And I think children, because they don't have these fixed knowledge structures, and they're learning so much, are filled with wonder just to make sense of the world. And one way we can reclaim awe is throw ourselves into new things, you know, and to humbly recognize the limits of our knowledge. And you know, the world conspires against that, right? We become, you know, we live in information bubbles and we become experts and we stop wondering at the world. And I think that the happiness science, I think reclaiming is a very powerful way to integrate it, Dan. We know how to practice gratitude. People have been doing it for tens, thousands of years. We know how to be kind and volunteer. We know where awe is. We need to reclaim it, right? We need to put down smartphones and, you know, and take a little time off of our busy work life and just get out to where we'll reclaim those experiences.
Yeah, I find that people overvalue what they know and undervalue what they don't know. You know, the don't know category is way bigger than the know category. So you addressed gratitude. It's come up. You know, in my clinical practice, I found that it changes people's lives, keeping a gratitude journal. So what's really going on here? I mean, that's a significant element. In our lives, it changes us.
Yeah.
How and what?
Yeah, you know, and I'm, it's so good to hear you say that, you know, Dan. I mean, in the science that we teach at Berkeley, it's really clear gratitude is one of the strong, it's easy, right? When I'm lying awake at night, I just think of three people I'm grateful for, and suddenly I'm flooded with an appreciation of those people. You know, when I went out and taught at San Quentin Prison and ask the prisoners what they're grateful for. They're grateful for all kinds of things, even though they're facing very harsh circumstances. So it's easy. And it does boost happiness and health. And that it is one of the strongest and easiest ways to lift up happiness. And I think what it does is two things, and I think they've been themes in our conversation. And one is gratitude, the feeling of reverence for things that are given to you, often by other people, gets the mind away from the self. And in general, when we move out of the self and look at other people, we're going to get happier. And I think that gratitude has this really deep sort of cognitive theme of just thinking about how great other, appreciating other people. And then the other thing that the science has started to document, and I'll bet your patients may feel this, Dan, which is that, you know, when you practice gratitude, so let's say I list three things I'm grateful for in the morning. That day, I'm starting to focus on more good things in my life, right? I may suddenly think about a work colleague and how generous they are. Or I may think about how nice it is that my knees are working pretty well and I can walk and vigorously. Or I may think about something that somebody gave me in the past, an opportunity. So it does tend to change the lens through which we look at our lives, and that's good stuff.
I want to add a caveat. You said you lay in bed and think of three people you're grateful for. When I send my patients out, or when I do it myself, I want them to experience happiness in their body. When you think about someone you're grateful for, feel it in your body. Notice whether it's a warm feeling or cold. Notice where in your body you're feeling this. That gets reinforced over and over. That feeling, that feeling becomes much more accessible.
Yeah, I think that's terrific, Dan. You know, I only cite the sleeping example because, like a lot of people, you know, sometimes I struggle with sleep. But a lot of the practices that I teach undergrads and audiences I teach are very embodied, you know, getting people to walk and stand up and move around and breathe as foundations to these happiness practices.
We're going to take a short break. You were listening to Dr. Keltner, a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY. Welcome back to this Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Joining us now is Rachel Drain. Rachel was diagnosed with major depressive disorder 7 years ago, but these days she's feeling much better, much, much better. And we also have Dr. Keltner, a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us.
Wow, thank you for having me.
Are you happy these days?
Yeah, that's, again, an interesting question. And I was thinking about it when I was listening to June speak earlier, that I think if I were asked that question just on the street, I would say yes. I feel like I am baseline and have always been a happy person. Just this depression has sort of dampened that. But also a thing that came up in my mind when I was listening to June is that happiness itself is not something that I think about as like a goal. It's not something that I think of when I'm thinking about the different things that I do with my life. It's just sort of a byproduct, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. You wrote a very personal and revealing article for a magazine called Invisible Illness. In it, you described how you were diagnosed with major depressive disorder those 7 years ago. How was your mind and heart before this happened?
Before this happened, my life was pretty full. Between like 20 to 25 credits,
different rehearsals, practices, and then having a social life. I was, I guess, what you would call like a social butterfly. So I think I was distracted a lot, and it took getting away from that for this to the depression and then, you know, all of the relating issues that I have had to work through to come to the surface. Like, yeah.
So this depression was so bad, so debilitating that you had to spend some time in what sounds like awful psychiatric hospital. But after you got out, you stayed with your dad, and you said you needed people around. I right after my accident, I was in shock. And to the first person that opened the door, I just said, call everybody I know to get here right away. What about people?
Oh, people. Well, while I was staying at the psychiatric hospital, I think we had visiting hours 3 days a week, and my dad didn't miss one, and he was able to bring my partner at the time as well. And I know that just having those people who knew me, regardless of what our relationships were like at that point, just having those people was everything. It got me through that time. And then being with my dad after was helpful, just because I knew that he would take care of me, that he would make sure that all my needs were met. And he has also struggled with his own depression. And so he gets it to a certain degree. I mean, we still sort of process information differently. I think he has a bit more of a rational mind, where I'm a bit more emotional, but he's still able to understand what's going on in my head, and is able to, when I say, oh, this is what I'm thinking about myself, he's able to say, no, honey, like, that's the illness. This is not true. You're, and he can, you know, hold me and be my human tissue if needed.
Boy, is that a gift.
Mm-hmm.
So, Doctor, I want to turn to you. We didn't talk about the role of relationships in happiness, and we know that people who are in good relationships are happier than others and tend to live longer.
Yeah, you know, and Rachel's wonderful narrative really brings that into focus, doesn't it? And, you know, I teach at Berkeley, you know, certain myths of happiness, and one of them I call the myth of individualism. And, you know, the United States is the most individualistic culture, focused on the self and freedom and autonomy. Those are good things, self-expression, but the scientific facts show that it's really what Rachel talked about that brings us happiness, which is when you turn to other people and they're connected to you, and when you're around them and when you feel they have your back. And so in the science of happiness, what we teach are, you know, relationships are a major pathway to happiness, and we talk about being cooperative and having social support and forgiving people and empathizing and really taking care to listen to others, just these relational practices that really build up your sense of being integrated into a community. And I think that that is ultimately the most important thing you can do to find happiness and health.
I wonder, Rachel, your response to some of what he said, specifically forgiveness. Now, I know you were pretty PO'd at the hospital, and you were PO'd at, you said in your essay, your first psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
who took you off all meds and sent you into this spiral.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk forgiveness. You've got a funny expression on your face.
I agree that forgiveness is a big part of lifting the burden off of oneself, and it's just interesting because I think that the real forgiveness might have just happened recently, at least with the doctor. I know with the hospital, at least I hope they were doing the best they could with the resources that they had. And maybe that's true of the doctor as well. But since that was a more like one-on-one personal relationship that felt more personal and that felt more frustrating just because it was also longer term. But I definitely agree that, you know, holding grudges and, you know, even being annoyed with someone really affects you more than, you know, it helps you to feel better than the other person or any sort of resolution. So it's a constant practice to, you know, sort of let that go.
Doctor, and Rachel, I had a guest on the show years ago, and he said holding on to resentment is like mud wrestling with a pig. You're both going to get dirty, but the pig's going to enjoy it. easy to say, hard to let go.
True.
So come back to your story, Rachel. You found a psychiatrist who you felt really understood. You really got you. And you said this actually began to change your life. You said you actually laughed at, what was it, John Oliver, host of HBO's Last Week Tonight. What was it about that somebody got you and cared about you? What did that do almost somatically, physically, to your body?
Yeah, I remember my first meeting with her. We were late because there was all tons of traffic, but my dad drove me. And pretty much the whole time I was just crying and trying to tell her what things were like and about how my previous psychiatrist thought that I was actually bipolar, and that's why he took me off of antidepressants. And just to hear her say that, no, this is not bipolar, this is definitely depression, like, we definitely need to get you back on track. I don't know, it was sort of like being heard or seen for the first time in a really long time. Like, sure, my family and friends could understand that I was struggling, but to have, I guess, a professional, someone who, you know, has no skin in the game, really, see my pain and understand that this is serious and we need to do some serious adjusting in order to help me live and feel better.
So what I'm hearing, and I'll turn to you, Doctor, on this. So what I'm hearing is compassion, care, and it almost triggers the parasympathetic nervous system, the nervous system that says, it's okay, that big exhalation.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Rachel's story, so eloquently put, is a story a lot of us feel, right? You hit a little piece of your life where, you know, things sort of bubble up and you fall into a state of generalized anxiety or social anxiety or depression, you know, and I mean, the estimates are 40% of Americans will have some sort of state or experience like that. And, you know, I think what we're learning in the study of human emotion is really aligning with what Rachel says, which is like just to be understood. And also to develop a sense within your mind that you accept this condition, as that it'll probably change. It may take a while, but it will transform as you develop. And my family, on my mom's side, has this deep history of anxiety, like clinical anxiety. I've had 3 or 4 years of panic attacks and, you know, what would be called panic disorder. And it all changed once I realized that this is okay. You know, that it is just part of who I am and it'll transform. And then, you know, and then it's critical to, you know, much as the clarification for Rachel that it wasn't bipolar, but it was a state of depression. We need the tools for insight into our complex emotions. And I think that here the science is really, you know, as we think about the benefits of negative emotions and it's okay to be fearful sometimes, or maybe you have some anger about an issue, that's okay. And there's amazing new science showing just this language that we develop about understanding our states gives us this insight. It calms the amygdala, the stress-related region of the brain, or one of the stress-related regions. So acceptance and insight matter profoundly, and that's what the great therapists and psychiatrists do.
Yeah, there's a phrase in a meditation practice that says, "May I accept my life as it is?" And to repeat that, you know, over and over when you're in a deep contemplative state, really helps, you know, and even saying it through the day. But yeah, it sounds to be exactly what you're talking about. I want to thank you both so much for joining us, for sharing your wisdom and insights. It's been wonderful. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Rachel Drain and Dr. Keltner. He's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. You know, without love, happiness is impossible. And if we have love in our lives, I think happiness is inevitable. I want to thank you for listening. It's been a Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Allie Lesbrons is the producer of Voices in the Family. Naomi Strobin has been our editor. Our executive producer is Elizabeth Perez Luna. And Al Banks has been our engineer. Thanks so much for listening.